Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Section 1 of the Maraco Deep. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Thomas Copeland. The Maraco Deep by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Section 1. Since these papers have been put into my hands to edit, I will begin by reminding the public of the sad loss of the steamship Stratford, which started a year ago upon a voyage for the purpose of oceanography and the study of deep-sea life. The expedition had been organized by Dr. Maraco, the famous author of Pseudo-Coralline Formations and the Morphology of the Lamellibranchs. Dr. Maraco had with him Mr. Cyrus Headley, formerly assistant at the Zoological Institute of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and at the time of the voyage Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. Captain Howey, an experienced navigator, was in charge of the vessel, and there was a crew of 23 men, including an American mechanic from the Meribank Works, Philadelphia. This whole party has utterly disappeared, and the only word ever heard of the ill-fated steamer was from the report of a Norwegian bark, which actually saw a ship, closely corresponding with her description, go down in the great gale of the autumn of 1926. A lifeboat, marked Stratford, was found later in the neighborhood of the tragedy, together with some deck gratings, a life buoy, and a spar. This, coupled with the long silence, seemed to make it absolutely sure that the vessel and her crew would never be heard of more. Her fate is rendered more certain by the strange wireless message received at the time, which, though incomprehensible in parts, left little doubt as to the fate of the vessel. This I will quote later. There were some remarkable points about the voyage of the Stratford which caused comment at the time. One was the curious secrecy observed by Professor Maraco. He was famous for his dislike and distrust of the press, but it was pushed to an extreme upon this occasion when he would neither give information to reporters, nor would he permit the representative of any paper to set foot in the vessel during the weeks that it lay in the Albert Dock. There were rumors abroad of some curious and novel construction of the ship which would fit it for deep-sea work, and these rumors were confirmed from the yard of Hunter and Company of West Hartlepool, where the structural changes had actually been carried out. It was at one time said that the whole bottom of the vessel was detachable, a report which attracted the attention of the underwriters at Lloyd's, who were with some difficulty satisfied upon the point. The matter was soon forgotten, but it assumes an importance now when the fate of the expedition has been brought once more in so extraordinary a manner to the notice of the public. So much for the beginning of the voyage of the Stratford. There are now four documents which cover the facts so far as they are known. The first is the letter which was written by Mr. Cyrus Headley from the capital of the Grand Canary to his friend Sir James Talbot of Trinity College, Oxford, upon the only occasion, so far as is known, when the Stratford touched land after leaving the Thames. The second is the strange wireless call to which I have alluded. The third is that portion of the log of the Arabella Knowles, which deals with the vitreous ball. The fourth and last is the amazing contents of that receptacle, which either represent a most cruel and complex mystification, or else open up a fresh chapter in human experience, the importance of which cannot be exaggerated. With this preamble, I will now give Mr. Headley's letter, which I owe to the courtesy of Sir James Talbot, and which has not previously been published. It is dated October 1, 1926. I am mailing this, my dear Talbot, from Porto de la Luz, where we have put in for a few days of rest. My principal companion in the voyage has been Bill Scanlon, the head mechanic, who, as a fellow countryman, and also as a very entertaining character, has become my natural associate. However, I am alone this morning, as he has what he describes as a date with a skirt. You see, he talks as Englishmen expect every real American to talk. He would be accepted as the true breed. The mere force of suggestion makes me guess and reckon when I am with my English friends. I feel that they would never really understand that I was a Yankee if I did not. However, I am not on those terms with you, so let me assure you right now that you will not find anything but pure Oxford in the epistle which I am now mailing to you. You met Marco at the Mitre, so you know the dry chip of a man that he is. I told you, I think, how he came to pitch for me for the job. He inquired from old Somerville of the Zoological Institute, who sent him my prize essay on the pelagic crabs, and that did the trick. Of course, it is splendid to be on such a congenial errand, but I wish it wasn't with such an animated mummy as Marco. He is inhuman in his isolation and his devotion to his work. "The world's stiffest stiff," says Bill Scanlon. And yet you can't but admire such complete devotion. Nothing exists outside his own science. I remember that you laughed when I asked him what I ought to read as a preparation, and he said that for serious study I should read the collected edition of his own works, but for relaxation, Haeckel's Plankton Studien. I know him no better now than I did in that little parlour looking out on the Oxford High. He says nothing, and his gaunt, austere face, the face of a Savonarola, or rather, perhaps, of a Torquemada, never relapses into geniality. The long, thin, aggressive nose, the two small, gleaming grey eyes set closely together under a thatch of eyebrows, the thin-lipped, compressed mouth, the cheeks worn into hollows by constant thought and ascetic life, are all uncompanionable. He lives on some mental mountaintop out of reach of ordinary mortals. Sometimes I think he is a little mad. For example, this extraordinary instrument that he has made. But I'll tell things in their due order, and then you can judge for yourself. I'll take our voyage from the start. The Stratford is a fine, seaworthy little boat, specially fitted for her job. She is 1,200 tons, with clear decks and a good broad beam, furnished with every possible appliance for sounding, trawling, dredging, and tow-netting. She has, of course, powerful steam winches for hauling in the trawls, and a number of other gadgets of various kinds, some of which are familiar enough, and some are strange. Below these are comfortable quarters with a well-fitted laboratory for our special studies. We had the reputation of being a mystery ship before we started, and I soon found that it was not undeserved. Our first proceedings were commonplace enough. We took a turn up the North Sea and dropped our trawls for a scrape or two, but as the average depth is not much over 60 feet, and we were specially fitted for very deep sea work, it seemed rather a waste of time. Anyhow, save for familiar tablefish, dogfish, squids, jellyfish, and some terrigenous bottom deposits of the usual alluvial clay mud, we got nothing worth writing home about. Then we rounded Scotland, sighted the Faroes, and came down the Wyville-Thompson Ridge, where we had better luck. Thence we worked south to our proper cruising ground, which was between the African coast and these islands. We nearly grounded on Fuerteventura one moonless night, but save for that our voyage was uneventful. During these first weeks I tried to make friends with Marco, but it was not easy work. First of all, he is the most absorbed and absent-minded man in the world. You will remember how you smiled when he gave the elevator boy a penny under the impression that he was in a streetcar. Half the time he is utterly lost in his thoughts, and seems hardly aware of where he is or what he is doing. Then, in the second place, he is secretive to the last degree. He is continually working at papers and charts, which he shuffles away when I happen to enter the cabin. It is my firm belief that the man has some secret project in his mind, but that, so long as we are due to touch at any port, he will keep it to himself. That is the impression which I have received, and I find that Bill Scanlon is of the same opinion. "Say, Mr. Headley," said he one evening, when I was seated in the laboratory, testing out the salinity of samples from our hydrographic soundings, "what do you figure out this guy has in his mind? What do you reckon that he means to do?" "I suppose," said I, "that we shall do what the Challenger and a dozen other exploring ships have done before us, and add a few more species to the list of fish, and a few more entries to the bathymetric chart." "Not on your life," said he. "If that's your opinion, you've got to guess again. First of all, what am I here for, anyhow?" "In case the machinery goes wrong," I hazarded. "Machinery, nothing. The ship's machinery is in charge of McLaren, the Scotch engineer." "No, sir, it wasn't to run a donkey engine that the Meribank folk sent out their star performer. If I pull down $50 a week, it's not for nicks. Come here, and I'll make you wise to it." He took a key from his pocket and opened a door at the back of the laboratory, which led us down a companion ladder to a section of the hold which was cleared right across, save for four large glittering objects, half exposed amid the straw of their huge packing cases. They were flat sheets of steel, with elaborate bolts and rivets along the edges. Each sheet was about 10 foot square and an inch and a half thick, with a circular gap of 18 inches in the middle. "What in thunder is it?" I asked. Bill Scanlon's queer face—he looks halfway between a vaudeville comic and a prize-fighter—broke into a grin at my astonishment. "That's my baby, sir," he quoted. "Yes, Mr. Headley, that's what I am here for. There is a steel bottom to the thing. It's in that big case yonder. Then there is a top, kind of arched, and a great ring for a chain or rope. Now, look here at the bottom of the ship." There was a square wooden platform there, with projecting screws at each corner, which showed that it was detachable. "There is a double bottom," said Scanlon. "It may be that this guy is clean loco, or it may be that he has more in his block than we know. But if I read him right, he means to build up a kind of room, the windows are in storage here, and lower it through the bottom of the ship. He's got electric searchlights here, and I allow that he plans to shine 'em through the round portholes and see what's going on around. He could have put a crystal sheet into the ship, like the Catalina Island boats, if that was all he had in his mind," said I. "You said a mouthful," said Bill Scanlon, scratching his head. "I can't figure it out nohow. The only one sure thing is that I've been sent to be under his orders and to help him with the darn fool thing all I can. He has said nothing up to now, so I've said the same. But I'll just snoop around, and if I wait long enough, I'll learn all there is to know." So that was how I first got on to the edge of our mystery. We ran into some dirty weather after that, and then we got to work doing some deep-sea trawling northwest of Cape Juba, just outside the continental slope, and taking temperature readings and salinity records. It's a sporting proposition, this deep-sea dragging, with a Peterson otter trawl gaping 20 feet wide for everything that comes its way, sometimes down a quarter of a mile, and bringing up one lot of fish, sometimes half a mile, and quite a different lot every stratum of ocean with its own inhabitants, as separate as so many continents. Sometimes from the bottom we would just bring up half a ton of clear pink jelly, the raw material of life, or maybe it would be a scoop of pteropod ooze, breaking up under the microscope into millions of tiny round reticulated balls with amorphous mud between. I won't bore you with all the brotulids and macrorids, the ascidians and the holothurians, and polyzoa and echinoderms. Anyhow, you can reckon that there is a great harvest in the sea, and that we have been diligent reapers. But always I had the same feeling that the heart of Marico was not in the job, and that other plans were in that queer, high, narrow Egyptian mummy of a head. It all seemed to me to be a tryout of men and things until the real business got going. I had got as far as this in my letter when I went ashore to have a last stretch, for we sail in the early morning. It's as well, perhaps, that I did go, for there was no end of a barney going on upon the pier, with Marico and Bill Scanlon right in the heart of it. Bill is a bit of a scrapper, and has what he calls a mean wallop in both mitts, but with half a dozen dagos with knives all round them, things looked ugly, and it was time that I butted in. It seems that the doctor had hired one of the things they call cabs, and had driven half over the island inspecting the geology, but had clean forgotten that he had no money on him. When it came to paying, he could not make these country hicks understand, and the cabman had grabbed his watch, so as to make sure. That brought Bill Scanlon into action, and they would have both been on the floor with their backs like pincushions if I had not squared the matter up with a dollar or two over for the driver and a $5 bonus for the chap with the mouse under his eye. So all ended well, and Marico was more human than ever I saw him yet. When we got to the ship, he called me into the little cabin which he reserves for himself, and he thanked me. "By the way, Mr. Headley," he said, "I understand that you are not a married man." "No," I said, "I am not." "No one depending upon you?" "No." "Good," said he. "I have not spoken of the object of this voyage, because I have, for my own reasons, desired it to be secret. One of those reasons was that I feared to be forestalled. When scientific plans get about, one may be served as Scott was served by Amundsen. Had Scott kept his counsel as I have done, it would be he, and not Amundsen, who would have been the first at the South Pole. For my part, I have quite as important a destination as the South Pole, and so I have been silent. But now we are on the eve of our great adventure, and no rival has time to steal my plans. Tomorrow we start for our real goal. "And what is that?" I asked. He leaned forward, his ascetic face all lit up with the enthusiasm of the fanatic. "Our goal," said he, "is the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean." And right here I ought to stop, for I expect it has taken away your breath as it did mine. If I were a story writer, I guess I should leave it at that. But as I am just a chronicler of what occurred, I may tell you that I stayed another hour in the cabin of Old Man Marico, and that I learned a lot, which there is still just time for me to tell you, before the last shoreboat leaves. "Yes, young man," said he, "you may write freely now, for by the time your letter reaches England we shall have made the plunge." This started him sniggering, for he has a queer dry sense of humour of his own. "Yes, sir, the plunge is the right word on this occasion, a plunge which will be historic in the annals of science. Let me tell you in the first place that I am well convinced that the current doctrine as to the extreme pressure of the ocean at great depths is entirely misleading. It is perfectly clear that other factors exist which neutralize the effect, though I am not yet prepared to say what those factors may be. That is one of the problems which we may settle. Now, what pressure, may I ask, have you been led to expect under a mile of water?" He glowered at me through his big horn spectacles. "Not less than a ton to the square inch," I answered. "Surely that has been clearly shown." "The task of the pioneer has always been to disprove the thing which has been clearly shown. Use your brains, young man. You have been for the last month fishing up some of the most delicate bathic forms of life, creatures so delicate that you could hardly transfer them from the net to the tank without marring their sensitive shapes. Did you find that there was evidence upon them of this extreme pressure?" "The pressure," said I, "equalized itself. It was the same within as without." "Words, mere words," he cried, shaking his lean head impatiently. "You have brought up round fish, such fish as Gastrostomus globulus. Would they not have been squeezed flat had the pressure been as you imagine? Or look at our otterboards. They are not squeezed together at the mouth of the trawl." "But the experience of divers?" "Certainly it holds good up to a point. They do find a sufficient increase of pressure to influence what is perhaps the most sensitive organ of the body, the interior of the ear. But as I plan it, we shall not be exposed to any pressure at all. We shall be lowered in a steel cage with crystal windows on each side for observation. If the pressure is not strong enough to break in an inch and a half of toughened double-nickeled steel, then it cannot hurt us. It is an extension of the experiment of the Williamson brothers at Nassau, with which no doubt you are familiar. If my calculation is wrong, well, you say that no one is dependent upon you. We shall die in a great adventure. Of course, if you would rather stand clear, I can go alone. It seemed to me the maddest kind of scheme, and yet you know how difficult it is to refuse a dare. I played for time while I thought it over. "How deep do you propose to go, sir?" I asked. He had a chart pinned upon the table, and he placed the end of his compasses upon a point which lies to the southwest of the Canaries. "Last year I did some sounding in this part," said he. "There is a pit of great depth. We got 25,000 feet there. I was the first to report it. Indeed, I trust that you will find it on the charts of the future, as the Marico Deep." "But, good God, sir," I cried, "you don't propose to descend into an abyss like that?" "No, no," he answered, smiling. "Neither our lowering chain nor our air-tubes reach beyond half a mile. But I was going to explain to you that round this deep crevasse, which has no doubt been formed by volcanic forces long ago, there is a raised ridge or narrow plateau, which is not more than 300 fathoms under the surface." 300 fathoms, a third of a mile? Yes, roughly a third of a mile. It is my present intention that we shall be lowered in our little pressure-proof lookout station onto this submarine bank. There we shall make such observations as we can. A speaking tube will connect us with the ship so that we can give our directions. There should be no difficulty in the matter. When we wish to be hauled up, we have only to say so. And the air? Will be pumped down to us. But it will be pitch dark. That, I fear, is undoubtedly true. The experiments of Fall and Saracen at the Lake of Geneva show that even the ultraviolet rays are absent at that depth. But does it matter? We shall be provided with the powerful electric illumination from the ship's engines, supplemented by 6 2-volt Helisons dry cells connected together so as to give a current of 12 volts. That, with a Lucas Army signaling lamp as a movable reflector, should serve our turn. Any other difficulties? If our airlines tangle? They won't tangle. And, as a reserve, we have compressed air in tubes which would last us 24 hours. Well, have I satisfied you? Will you come? It was not an easy decision. The brain works quickly, and imagination is a mighty vivid thing. I seemed to realize that black box down in the primeval depths, to feel the foul, twice-breathed air, and then to see the walls sagging, bulging inwards, rending at the joints, with the water spouting in at every rivet-hole and crevice, and crawling up from below. It was a slow, dreadful death to die. But I looked up, and there were the old man's fiery eyes fixed upon me with the exultation of a martyr to science. It's catching, that sort of enthusiasm, and if it be crazy, it is at least noble and unselfish. I caught fire from his great flame, and I sprang to my feet with my hand out. "Doctor, I'm with you to the end," said I. "I knew it," said he. "It was not for your smattering of learning that I picked you, my young friend, nor," he added, smiling, "for your intimate acquaintance with the pelagic crabs. There are other qualities which may be more immediately useful, and they are loyalty and courage." So, with that little bit of sugar, I was dismissed, with my future pledged and my whole scheme of life in ruins. Well, the last shore boat is leaving, and they are calling for the mail. You will either not hear from me again, my dear Talbot, or you will get a letter worth reading. If you don't hear, you can have a floating headstone and drop it somewhere south of the Canaries with the inscription, "Here or hereabouts lies all that the fishes have left of my friend Cyrus J. Headley." The second document in the case is the unintelligible wireless message which was intercepted by several vessels, including the Royal Mail steamer Arroyo. It was received at 3 p.m. October 3, 1926, which shows that it was dispatched only 2 days after the Stratford left the Grand Canary, as shown in the previous letter, and it corresponds roughly with the time when the Norwegian bark saw a steamer founder in a cyclone 200 miles to the southwest of Porto de la Luz. It ran thus: Blown on our beam ends, fear position hopeless, have already lost Marico, Headley, Scanlon, situation incomprehensible, Headley, handkerchief, end of deep sea sounding wire, God help us, S.S. Stratford. This was the last incoherent message which came from the ill-fated vessel, and part of it was so strange that it was put down to delirium on the part of the operator. It seemed, however, to leave no doubt as to the fate of the ship. The explanation, if it can be accepted as an explanation, of the matter is to be found in the narrative concealed inside the vitreous ball, and first it would be as well to amplify the very brief account which has hitherto appeared in the press of the finding of the ball. I take it verbatim from the log of the Arabella Knowles, Master Amos Green, outward bound with coals from Cardiff to Buenos Aires. Wednesday, January 5th, 1927. Latitude 27.14. Longitude 28 west. Calm weather. Blue sky with low banks of cirrus clouds. Sea like glass. At 2 bells of the middle watch, the first officer reported that he had seen a shining object bound high out of the sea and then fall back into it. His first impression was that it was some strange fish, but on examination with his glasses he observed that it was a silvery globe, or ball, which was so light that it lay, rather than floated, on the surface of the water. I was called and saw it, as large as a football, gleaming brightly, about 1/2 mile off on our starboard beam. I stopped the engines and called away the quarter-boat under the second mate, who picked the thing up and brought it aboard. On examination, it proved to be a ball made of some sort of very tough glass, and filled with a substance so light that when it was tossed in the air it wavered about like a child's balloon. It was nearly transparent, and we could see what looked like a roll of paper inside it. The material was so tough, however, that we had the greatest possible difficulty in breaking the ball open and getting at the contents. A hammer would not crack it, and it was only when the chief engineer nipped it in the throw of the engine that we were able to smash it. Then, I am sorry to say, that it dissolved into sparkling dust, so that it was impossible to collect any good-sized piece for examination. We got the paper, however, and having examined it, and concluded that it was of great importance, we laid it aside with the intention of handing it over to the British consul when we reached the Plate River. Man and boy, I have been at sea for 35 years, but this is the strangest thing that ever befell me, and so says every man aboard this ship. I leave the meaning of it all to wiser heads than mine. So much for the genesis of the narrative of Cyrus J. Headley, which we will now give exactly as written. Whom am I writing to? Well, I suppose I may say to the whole wide world. But as that is rather a vague address, I'll aim at my friend Sir James Talbot of Oxford University, for the reason that my last letter was to him, and this may be regarded as a continuation. I expect the odds are 100 to 1 that this ball, even if it should see the light of day and not be gulped by a shark in passing, will toss about on the waves and never catch the eye of the passing sailor. And yet it's worth trying, and Marico is sending up another, so between us it may be that we shall get our wonderful story to the world. Whether the world will believe it is another matter, I guess, but when folk look at the ball with its vitrine cover and note its contents of levigen gas, they will surely see for themselves that there is something here that is out of the ordinary. You, at any rate, Talbot, will not throw it aside unread. If anyone wants to know how the thing began and what we were trying to do, he can find it all in a letter I wrote you on October 1st last year, the night before we left Porto de la Luz. By George, if I had known what was in store for us, I think I should have sneaked into a shore-boat that night. And yet, well, maybe even with my eyes open, I would have stood by the doctor and seen it through. On second thoughts, I have not a doubt that I would. Well, starting from the day that we left Gran Canary, I will carry on with my experiences. The moment we were clear of the port, old man Marico fairly broke into flames. The time for action had come at last, and all the damped-down energy of the man came flaring up. I tell you, he took hold of that ship and of everyone and everything in it, and bent it all to his will. The dry, creaking, absent-minded scholar had suddenly vanished, and instead there emerged a human electrical machine, crackling with vitality and quivering from the great driving force within. His eyes gleamed behind his glasses like flames in a lantern. He seemed to be everywhere at once, working out distances on his chart, comparing reckonings with the skipper, driving Bill Scanlon along, setting me on to 100-odd jobs. But it was all full of method and with a definite end. He developed an unexpected knowledge of electricity and of mechanics, and spent much of his time working at the machinery which Scanlon, under his supervision, was now carefully piecing together. "Say, Mr. Headley, it's just dandy," said Bill, on the morning of the second day. "Come in here and have a look. The doc is a regular fellow and a whale of a slick mechanic." I had a most unpleasant impression that it was my own coffin at which I was gazing, but even so I had to admit that it was a very adequate mausoleum. The floor had been clamped to the four steel walls, and the porthole windows screwed into the centre of each. A small trap-door at the top gave admission, and there was a second one at the base. The steel cage was supported by a thin but very powerful steel hawser, which ran over a drum, and was paid out or rolled in by the strong engine which we used for our deep-sea trawls. The hawser, as I understood, was nearly half a mile in length, the slack of it coiled round bollards on the deck. The rubber breathing tubes were of the same length, and the telephone wire was connected with them, and also the wire by which the electric lights within could be operated from the ship's batteries, though we had an independent installment as well. It was on the evening of that day that the engines were stopped. The glass was low, and a thick black cloud rising upon the horizon gave warning of coming trouble. The only ship in sight was a bark flying the Norwegian colours, and we observed that it was reefed down, as if expecting trouble. For the moment, however, all was propitious, and the Stratford rolled gently upon a deep blue ocean, white-capped here and there from the breath of the trade wind. Bill Scanlon came to me in my laboratory with more show of excitement than his easy-going temperament had ever permitted him to show. "Look at here, Mr. Headley," said he. "They've lowered that contraption into a well in the bottom of the ship. Do you figure that the boss is going down in it?"
"Certain, sure, Bill, and I am going with him." "Well, well, you are sure bunghouse, the two of you, to think of such a thing. But I'd feel a cheapskate if I let you go alone."
"It is no business of yours, Bill."
"Well, I just feel that it is. Sure, I'd be as yellow as a chink with the jaundice if I let you go alone. Merrybank sent me here to look after the machinery, and if the machinery is down at the bottom of the sea, then it's a sure thing that it's me for the bottom. Where those steel castings are, that's the address of Bill Scanlon, whether the folk round him are crazy or no." It was useless to argue with him, so one more was added to our little suicide club, and we just waited for our orders. All night they were hard at work upon the fittings, and it was after an early breakfast that we descended into the hold, ready for our adventure. The steel cage had been half-lowered into the false bottom, and we now descended one by one through the upper trap-door, which was closed and screwed down behind us, Captain Howey, with a most lugubrious face, having shaken hands with each of us as we passed him. We were then lowered a few more feet, the shutter drawn above our heads, and the water admitted to test how far we were really seaworthy. The cage stood the trial well, every joint fitted exactly, and there was no sign of any leakage. Then the lower flap in the hold was loosened, and we hung suspended in the ocean beneath the level of the keel. It was really a very snug little room, and I marvelled at the skill and foresight with which everything had been arranged. The electric illumination had not been turned on, but the semi-tropical sun shone brightly through the bottle-green water at either porthole. Some small fish were flickering here and there, streaks of silver against the green background. Inside there was a settee round the little room, with a bathymetric dial, a thermometer, and other instruments ranged above it.
Beneath the settee was a row of pipes, which represented our reserve supply of compressed air, in case the tube should fail us. Those tubes opened out above our heads, and the telephonic apparatus hung beside them. We could all hear the mournful voice of the captain outside.
"Are you really determined to go?" he asked.
"We are quite all right," the doctor answered impatiently. "You will lower slowly and have someone at the receiver all the time. I will report conditions. When we reach the bottom, remain as you are until I give instructions. It will not do to put too much strain upon the hawser, but a slow movement of a couple of knots an hour should be well within its strength.
And now, lower away!"
He yelled out the two words with the scream of a lunatic. It was the supreme moment of his life, the fruition of all his brooding dreams. For an instant I was shaken by the thought that we were really in the power of a cunning, plausible monomaniac. Bill Scanlon had the same thought, for he looked across at me with a rueful grin and touched his forehead. But after that one wild outburst, our leader was instantly his sober, self-contained self once more. Indeed, one had but to look at the order and forethought which showed itself in every detail around us to be reassured as to the power of his mind. But now all our attention was diverted to the wonderful new experience which every instant was providing. Slowly the cage was sinking into the depths of the ocean. Light green water turned to dark olive. That again deepened into a wonderful blue, a rich, deep blue, gradually thickening to a dusky purple. Lower and lower we sank, 100 feet, 200 feet, 300. The valves were acting to perfection. Our breathing was as free and natural as upon the deck of the vessel. Slowly the bathymeter needle moved round the luminous dial. 400, 500, 600. "How are you?" roared an anxious voice from above us.
"Nothing could be better,"
cried Marco in reply. But the light was failing. There was now only a dim grey twilight, which rapidly changed to utter darkness.
"Stop her!"
shouted our leader. We ceased to move and hung suspended at 700 feet below the surface of the ocean. I heard the click of the switch, and the next instant we were flooded with glorious golden light, which poured out through each of our side windows and sent long, glimmering vistas into the waste of waters round us. With our faces against the thick glass, each at our own porthole, we gazed out into such a prospect as man had never seen. Up to now we had known these strata by the sight of the few fish which had been too slow to avoid our clumsy trawl, or too stupid to escape a dragnet. Now we saw the wonderful world of water as it really was. If the object of creation was the production of man, it is strange that the ocean is so much more populous than the land. Broadway on a Saturday night, Lombard Street on a weekday afternoon, are not more crowded than the great sea spaces which lay before us. We had passed those surface strata where fish are either colourless or of the true maritime tints of ultramarine above and silver below. Here there were creatures of every conceivable tint and form which pelagic life can show. Delicate leptocephali, or eel larvae, shot like streaks of burnished silver across the tunnel of radiance. The slow, snake-like form of Murina, the deep-sea lamprey, writhed and twisted by, or the black serratia, all spikes and mouth, gaped foolishly back at our peering faces. Sometimes it was the squat cuttlefish, which drifted across and glanced at us with human, sinister eyes. Sometimes it was some crystal-clear pelagic form of life, cystoma or glaucus, which lent a flower-like charm to the scene. One huge carynx, or horse mackerel, butted savagely again and again against our window until the dark shadow of a 7-foot shark came across him, and he vanished into the gaping jaws. Dr. Marco sat entranced, his notebook upon his knee, scribbling down his observations and keeping up a muttered monologue of scientific comment. "What's that? What's that?" I would hear. "Yes, yes, Chimaera mirabilis is taken by the Michael Sars. Dear me, there is Lepidian, but a new species, as I should judge.
"'Observe that macrorus, Mr. Headley. "'Its colouring is quite different to what we get in the net.' "'Once only was he taken quite aback. "'It was when a long oval object "'shot with great speed past his window from above "'and left a vibrating tail behind it "'which extended, as far as we could see, above us and below. "'I admit that I was as puzzled for the moment as the doctor, "'and it was Bill Scanlon who solved the mystery.'
I guess that boob John Sweeney has heaved his lead alongside of us. Kind of a joke, maybe, to prevent us from feeling lonesome.
to be sure, said Marico, sniggering. Plumus longicaudatus, a new genus, Mr. Headley, with a piano wire tail and lead in its nose. But indeed it is very necessary they should take soundings so as to keep above the bank, which is circumscribed in size.
All well, Captain,
he shouted.
You would drop us down.
And down we went. Dr. Marico turned off the electric light, and all was pitch darkness once more, save for the bathymeter's luminous face, which ticked off our steady fall. There was a gentle sway, but otherwise we were hardly conscious of any motion. Only that moving hand upon the dial told us of our terrific, our inconceivable position. Now we were at the 1,000-foot level, and the air had become distinctly foul. Scanlon oiled the valve of the discharge tube, and things were better. At 1,500 feet we stopped, and swung in mid-ocean with our lights blazing once more. Some great dark mass passed us here, but whether swordfish or deep-sea shark or monster of unknown breed was more than we could determine. The doctor hurriedly turned off the lights. "'There lies our chief danger,' said he. "'There are creatures in the deep, "'before whose charge this steel-plated room "'would have as much chance as a beehive "'before the rush of rhinoceros. "'Whales, maybe,' said Scanlon. "'Whales may sound to a great depth,' the savant answered. "'A Greenland whale has been known to take out "'nearly a mile of line in a perpendicular dive. "'But unless hurt or badly frightened, "'no whale would descend so low.' It may have been a giant squid. They are found at every level. Well, I guess squids are too soft to hurt us. The laugh would be with the squid if he could claw a hole in Merribank's nickel steel. Their bodies may be soft, the professor answered, but the beak of a large squid would shear through a bar of iron, and one peck of that beak might go through these inch-thick windows as if they were parchment. Gee, Whittaker, said Bill, as we resumed our downward journey. And then, at last, quite softly and gently, we came to rest. So delicate was the impact that we should hardly have known of it, had it not been that the light, when turned on, showed great coils of the hawser all around us. The wire was a danger to our breathing tubes, for it might foul them, and at the urgent cry of Marico it was pulled taut from above once more. The dial marked 1,800 feet. We lay motionless on a volcanic ridge at the bottom of the Atlantic. End of section one. Section two of The Marico Deep by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Thomas Copeland. Two. For a time, I think that we all had the same feeling. We did not want to do anything or to see anything. We just wanted to sit quiet and try to realize the wonder of it, that we should be resting in the plumb center of one of the great oceans of the world. But soon, the strange scene round us, illuminated in all directions by our lights, drew us to the windows. We had settled upon a bed of high algae, Cutlaria multifida, said Marico, the yellow fronds of which waved around us, moved by some deep-sea current, exactly as branches would move in a summer breeze. They were not long enough to obscure our view, though their great flat leaves, deep golden in the light, flowed occasionally across our vision. Beyond them lay slopes of some blackish, slag-like material, which were dotted with lovely colored creatures, holothurians, ascidians, echini, and echinoderms, as thickly as ever an English springtime bank was sprinkled with hyacinths and primroses. These living flowers of the sea, vivid scarlet,
rich purple and delicate pink, were spread in profusion upon that coal-black background. Here and there, great sponges bristled out from the crevices of the dark rocks, and a few fish of the middle depths, themselves showing up as flashes of color, shot across our circle of vivid radiance. We were gazing enraptured at the fairy scene when an anxious voice came down the tube.
"Well, how do you like the bottom? Is all well with you? Don't be too long, for the glass is dropping, and I don't like the look of it. Giving you air enough? Anything more we can do?"
"All right, Captain,"
cried Mariko cheerily.
"We won't be long. You are nursing us well. We are quite as comfortable as in our own cabin. Stand by presently to move us slowly forwards."
We had come into the region of the luminous fishes, and it amused us to turn out our own lights, and in the absolute pitch darkness, a darkness in which a sensitive plate can be suspended for an hour without a trace even of the ultraviolet ray, to look out at the phosphorescent activity of the ocean. As against a black velvet curtain, one saw little points of brilliant light moving steadily along as a liner at night might shed light through its long line of portholes. One terrifying creature had luminous teeth which gnashed in biblical fashion in the outer darkness. Another had long golden antennae, and yet another a plume of flame above its head. As far as our vision carried, brilliant points flashed in the darkness, each little being bent upon its own business and lighting up its own course as surely as the nightly taxicab at the theatre hour in the Strand. Soon we had our own lights up again, and the doctor was making his observations of the sea bottom.
"Deep as we are not deep enough to get any of the characteristic bathic deposits," said he. "These are entirely beyond our possible range. Perhaps on another occasion, with a longer hawser—" "Cut it out," growled Bill. "Forget it,"
Mariko smiled. "You will soon get acclimatized to the depths, Scanlon. This will not be our only descent."
"The hell you say," muttered Bill.
"He will think no more of it than of going down into the hold of the Stratford. You will observe, Mr. Headley, that the groundwork here, so far as we can observe it through the dense growth of hydrozoa and siliceous sponges, is pumice stone and the black slag of basalt, pointing to ancient plutonic activities. Indeed, I am inclined to think that it confirms my previous view that this ridge is part of a volcanic formation, and that the Mariko Deep," he rolled out the words as if he loved them, "represents the outer slope of the mountain. It has struck me that it would be an interesting experiment to move our cage slowly onwards until we come to the edge of the deep, and see exactly what the formation may be at that point. I should expect to find a precipice of majestic dimensions extending downward at a sharp angle into the extreme depths of the ocean. The experiment seemed to me to be a dangerous one, for who could say how far our thin hawser could bear the strain of lateral movement? But with Mariko, danger, either to himself or to anyone else, simply did not exist when a scientific observation had to be made. I held my breath, and so, I observed, did Bill Scanlon, when the slow movement of our steel shell brushing against the waving fronds of seaweed showed that the full strain was put upon the line. It stood it nobly, however, and with a very gentle sweeping progression we began to glide over the bottom of the ocean, Mariko, with the compass in the hollow of his hand, shouting his direction as to the course to follow, and occasionally ordering the shell to be raised so as to avoid some obstacle in our path. "This basaltic ridge can hardly be more than a mile across," he explained. "I had marked the abyss as being to the west of the point where we took our plunge. At this rate, we should certainly reach it in a very short time." We slid without any check over the volcanic plain, all feathered by the waving golden algae, and made beautiful by the gorgeous jewels of nature's cutting, flaming out from their setting of jet. Suddenly the doctor dashed to the telephone.
"Stop her!" he cried. "We are there!"
A monstrous gap had opened suddenly before us. It was a fearsome place, the vision of a nightmare. Black, shining cliffs of basalt fell sheer down into the unknown. Their edges were fringed with dangling laminaria, as ferns might overhang some earthly gorge. But beneath that tossing, vibrating rim, there were only the black, gleaming walls of the chasm. The rocky edge curved away from us, but the abyss might be of any breadth, for our lights failed to penetrate the gloom which lay before us. When a Lucas signaling lamp was turned downwards, it shot out a long golden lane of parallel beams extending down, 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 until it was quenched in the gloom of the terrible chasm beneath us. "It is indeed wonderful," cried Marricot, gazing out with a pleased proprietary expression upon his thin, eager face. "For depth, I need not say that it has often been exceeded. There is the Challenger Deep of 26,000 feet near the Landrone Islands, the Planet Deep of 32,000 feet off the Philippines, and many others. But it is probable that the Marricot Deep stands alone in the declivity of its descent, and is remarkable also for its escape from the observation of so many hydrographic explorers who have charted the Atlantic. It can hardly be doubted..." He had stopped in the middle of a sentence, and a look of intense interest and surprise had frozen upon his face. Bill Scanlon and I, gazing over his shoulders, were petrified by that which met our startled eyes. Some great creature was coming up the tunnel of light which we had projected into the abyss. Far down where it tailed off into the darkness of the pit, we could dimly see the vague black lurchings and heavings of some monstrous body in slow upward progression. Paddling in clumsy fashion, it was rising with dim flickerings to the edge of the gulf. Now, as it came nearer, it was right in the beam, and we could see its dreadful form more clearly. It was a beast unknown to science, and yet with an analogy to much with which we are familiar. Too long for a huge crab, and too short for a giant lobster, it was molded more upon the lines of the crayfish, with two monstrous nippers outstretched on either side, and a pair of 16-foot antennae, which quivered in front of its black, dull, sullen eyes. The carapace, light yellow in color, may have been 10 feet across, and its total length, apart from the antennae, must have been not less than 30. "Wonderful!" cried Marricot, scribbling desperately in his notebook. "Semi-pediculated eyes, elastic lamellae, family crustacea, species unknown. Crustaceous Marricotae, why not? Why not?" "By gosh, I'll pass its name, but it seems to me it's coming our way," cried Bill. "Say, Doc, what about putting our light out?"
"Just one moment while I note the reticulations," cried the naturalist. "Yes, yes, that will do." He clicked off the switch, and we were back in our inky darkness, with only the darting lights outside like meteors on a moonless night.
"That beast is sure the world's worst," said Bill, wiping his forehead. "I felt like the morning after a bottle of Prohibition hooch." "It is certainly terrible to look at," Marricot remarked, "and perhaps terrible to deal with also, if we were really exposed to those monstrous claws. But inside our steel case we can afford to examine him in safety and at our ease." He had hardly spoken when there came a rap, as from a pickaxe, upon our outer wall. Then there was a long-drawn rasping and scratching, ending in another sharp rap. "Say, he wants to come in," cried Bill Scanlon in alarm. "By gosh, we want no admission painted on this shack." His shaking voice showed how forced was his merriment, and I confess that my own knees were knocking together as I was aware of the stealthy monster closing up with an even blacker darkness each of our windows in succession, as he explored this strange shell, which, could he but crack it, might contain his food." "He can't hurt us," said Marricot, but there was less assurance in his tone. "Maybe it would be as well to shake the brute off." He hailed the captain up the tube.
"Pull us up 20 or 30 feet,"
he cried. A few seconds later we rose from the lava plain and swung gently in the still water. But the terrible beast was pertinacious. After a very short interval we heard once more the raspings of his feelers and the sharp tappings of his claws as he felt us round. It was terrible to sit silently in the dark and know that death was so near. If that mighty claw fell upon the window, Would it stand the strain? That was the unspoken question of each of our minds. But suddenly an unexpected and more urgent danger presented itself. The tappings had gone to the roof of our little dwelling, and now we began to sway with a rhythmic movement to and fro. "Good God!" I cried. "It has hold of the hawser. It will surely snap it." "Say, Doc, it's mine for the surface. I guess we've seen what we came to see, and it's home, sweet home, for Bill Scanlon. Bring up the elevator and get her going."
"But our work is not half done," croaked Marico. "We have only begun to explore the edges of the deep. Let us at least see how broad it is. When we have reached the other side, I shall be content to return." Then up the tube.
"All well, Captain. Move on at 2 knots until I call for a stop."
We moved slowly out over the edge of the abyss. Since darkness had not saved us from attack, we now turned on our lights. One of the portholes was entirely obscured by what appeared to be the creature's lower stomach. Its head and its great nippers were at work above us, and we still swayed like a clanging bell. The strength of the beast must have been enormous. Were ever mortals placed in such a situation, with 5 miles of water beneath and that deadly monster above? The oscillations became more and more violent. An excited shout came down the tube from the captain as he became aware of the jerks upon the hawser, and Marico sprang to his feet with his hands thrown upwards in despair. Even within the shell we were aware of the jar of the broken wires, and an instant later we were falling into the mighty gulf beneath us. As I look back at that awful moment, I can remember hearing a wild cry from Marico.
"The hawser has parted. You can do nothing. We are all dead men," he yelled, grabbing at a telephone tube, and then, "Goodbye, Captain. Goodbye to all."
They were our last words to the world of men. We did not fall swiftly down, as you might have imagined. In spite of our weight, our hollow shell gave us some sustaining buoyancy, and we sank slowly and gently into the abyss. I heard the long scrape as we slid through the claws of the horrible creature who had been our ruin, and then, with a smooth gyration, we went circling downwards into the abysmal depths. It may have been fully 5 minutes, and it seemed like an hour, before we reached the limit of our telephone wire and snapped it like a thread. Our air tube broke off at almost the same moment, and the salt water came spouting through the vents. With quick, deft hands, Bill Scanlon tied cords round each of the rubber tubes and so stopped the inrush, while the doctor released the top of our compressed air, which came hissing forth from the tubes. The lights had gone out when the wire snapped, but even in the dark the doctor was able to connect up the Hellison's dry cells, which lit a number of lamps in the roof. "It should last us a week," he said, with a wry smile. "We shall at least have light to die in." Then he shook his head sadly, and a kindly smile came over his gaunt features. "It is all right for me. I am an old man, and have done my work in the world. My one regret is that I should have allowed you 2 young fellows to come with me. I should have taken the risk alone." I simply shook his hand in reassurance, for indeed there was nothing I could say. Bill Scanlon, too, was silent. Slowly we sank, marking our pace by the dark fish shadows which flitted past our windows. It seemed as if they were flying upwards, rather than that we were sinking down. We still oscillated, and there was nothing, so far as I could see, to prevent us from falling on our side, or even turning upside down. Our weight, however, was, fortunately, very evenly balanced, and we kept a level floor. Glancing up at the bathymeter, I saw that we had already reached the depth of a mile. "You see, it is as I said," remarked Marico with some complacency. "You may have seen my paper in the Proceedings of the Oceanographical Society upon the relation of pressure and depth. I wish I could get one word back to the world, if only to confute Hulot of Geissen, who ventured to contradict me." "My gosh! If I could get word back to the world, I wouldn't waste it on a square-head highbrow," said the mechanic. "There is a little wren in Philadelphia that will have tears in her pretty eyes when she hears that Bill Scanlon has passed out. Well, it surely does seem a dumb, queer way of doing it, anyhow."
"You should never have come," I said, putting my hand on his. "What sort of tin-horn sport should I have been if I had quitted?" he answered. "No, it's my job, and I am glad I stuck it." "How long have we?" I asked the doctor after a pause. He shrugged his shoulders. "We shall have time to see the real bottom of the ocean anyhow," said he. "There is air enough in our tubes for the best part of a day. Our trouble is with the waste products. That is what is going to choke us. If we could get rid of our carbon dioxide..." "That, I can see, is impossible." "There is one tube of pure oxygen. I put it in case of accidents. A little of that from time to time will help to keep us alive. You will observe that we are now more than 2 miles deep." "Why should we try to keep ourselves alive? The sooner it is over, the better," said I. "That's the dope," cried Scanlon. "Cut loose and have done with it." "And miss the most wonderful sight that man's eye has ever seen?" said Marico. "It would be treason to science. Let us record facts to the end, even if they should be forever buried with our bodies. Play the game out." "Some sport, the doc," said Scanlon. "I guess he has the best guts of the bunch. Let us see the spiel to an end." We sat patiently on the settee, the three of us, gripping the edges of it with strained fingers as it swayed and rocked, while the fishes still flashed swiftly upwards athwart the portholes. "It is now 3 miles," remarked Marico. "I will turn on the oxygen, Mr. Headley, for it is certainly very close. There is one thing," he added, with his dry, cackling laugh. "It will certainly be the Marico Deep from this time onwards. When Captain Howe takes back the news, my colleagues will see to it that my grave is also my monument. Even Bülow of Giessen..." He babbled on about some unintelligible scientific grievance. We sat in silence again, watching the needle as it crawled on to its 4th mile. At one point we struck something heavy, which shook us so violently that I feared that we should turn upon our side. It may have been a huge fish, or conceivably we may have bumped upon some projection of the cliff over the edge of which we had been precipitated. That edge had seemed to us at the time to be such a wondrous depth, and now, looking back at it from our dreadful abyss, it might almost have been the surface. Still, we swirled and circled lower and lower through the dark green waste of waters. 25,000 feet now was registered upon the dial. "We are nearly at our journey's end," said Marico. "My Scots recorder gave me 26,700 last year at the deepest point. We shall know our fate within a few minutes. It may be that the shock will crush us. It may be..." And at that moment we landed. There was never a babe lowered by its mother onto a feather bed who nestled down more gently than we onto the extreme bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. The soft, thick, elastic ooze upon which we lit was a perfect buffer, which saved us from the slightest jar. We hardly moved upon our seats, and it is as well that we did not, for we had perched upon some sort of a projecting hummock, clothed thickly with the viscous, gelatinous mud, and there we were balanced, rocking gently with nearly half our base projecting and unsupported. There was a danger that we would tip over on our side, but finally we steadied down and remained motionless. As we did so, Dr. Marico, staring out through his porthole, gave a cry of surprise and hurriedly turned out our electric light. To our amazement, we could still see clearly. There was a dim, misty light outside which streamed through our porthole like the cold radiance of a winter morning. We looked out at the strange scene, and with no help from our own lights, we could see clearly for some 100 yards in each direction. It was impossible, inconceivable, but nonetheless the evidence of our senses told us that it was a fact. The great ocean floor is luminous. "Why not?" cried Marico, when we had stood for a minute or two in silent wonder. "Should I not have foreseen it? What is this pteropod or globigerina ooze? Is it not the product of decay, the mouldering bodies of a billion organic creatures? And is decay not associated with phosphorescent luminosity? Where in all creation would it be seen if it were not here? Oh, it is indeed hard that we should have such a demonstration and be unable to send our knowledge back to the world.
And yet, I remarked, we have scooped half a ton of radiolarian jelly at a time, and detected no such radiance. It would lose it, doubtless, in its long journey to the surface. But what is half a ton compared to these far-stretching plains of slow putrescence? And see, see, he cried, in uncontrollable excitement, the deep-sea creatures graze upon this organic carpet, even as our herds on land graze upon the meadows. As he spoke, a flock of big black fish, heavy and squat, came slowly over the ocean bed towards us, nuzzling among the spongy growths and nibbling away as they advanced. Another huge red creature, like a foolish cow of the ocean, was chewing the cud in front of my porthole, and others were grazing here and there, raising their heads from time to time to gaze at this strange object which had so suddenly appeared among them. I could only marvel at Marco, who in that foul atmosphere, seated under the very shadow of death, still obeyed the call of science, and scribbled his observations in his notebook. Without following his precise methods, I nonetheless made my own mental notes, which will remain forever as a picture stamped upon my brain. The lowest plains of ocean consist of red clay, but here it was overlaid by the gray Bathybian slime, which formed an undulating plain as far as our eyes could reach. This plain was not smooth, but was broken by numerous strange rounded hillocks, like that upon which we had perched, all glimmering in the spectral light. Between these little hills there darted great clouds of strange fish, many of them quite unknown to science, exhibiting every shade of color, but black and red predominating. Marco watched them with suppressed excitement, and chronicled them in his notes. The air had become very foul, and again we were only able to save ourselves by a fresh emission of oxygen. Curiously enough, we were all hungry, I should rather say ravenous, and we fell upon the potted beef with bread and butter, washed down by whiskey and water, which the foresight of Marco had provided. With my perceptions stimulated by this refreshment, I was seated in my lookout portal and longing for a last cigarette when my eyes caught something which sent a whirl of strange thoughts and anticipations through my mind. I have said that the undulatory gray plain on every side of us was studded with what seemed like hummocks. A particularly large one was in front of my porthole, and I looked out at it within a range of 30 feet. There was some peculiar mark upon the side of it, and as I glanced along, I saw to my surprise that this mark was repeated again and again, until it was lost round the curve. When one is so near death, it takes much to give one a thrill about anything connected with this world. But my breath failed me for a moment, and my heart stood still as I suddenly realized that it was a frieze at which I was looking, and that, barnacled and worn as it was, the hand of man had surely at some time carved these faded figures. Marco and Scanlan crowded to my porthole and gazed out in utter amazement at these signs of the omnipresent energies of man. "It is a carving, for sure," cried Scanlan. "I guess this dump has been the roof of a building. Then these other ones are buildings also. Say, boss, we've dropped plumb on to a regular burg." "It is indeed an ancient city," said Marco. "Geology teaches that the seas have once been continents, and the continents seas. But I have always distrusted the idea that in times so recent as the Quaternary there could have been an Atlantic subsidence. Plato's report of Egyptian gossip had then a foundation of fact. These volcanic formations confirm the view that this subsidence was due to seismic activity." "There is regularity about these domes," I remarked. "I begin to think that they are not separate houses, but that they are cupolas and form the ornaments of the roof of some huge building." "I guess you are right," said Scanlan. "There are 4 big ones at the corners, and the small ones in lines between. It's some building if we could see the whole of it. You could put the whole Meribank plant inside it, and then some." "It has been buried up to the roof by the constant dropping from above," said Marco.
On the other hand, it is not decayed. We have a constant temperature of a little over 32 degrees Fahrenheit in the great depths, which would arrest destructive processes. Even the dissolution of the bathic remains, which pave the floor of the ocean and incidentally give us this luminosity, must be a very slow one. But, dear me, this marking is not a frieze, but an inscription. There was no doubt that he was right. The same symbol recurred every here and there. These marks were unquestionably letters of some archaic alphabet. I have made a study of Phoenician antiquities, and there is certainly something suggestive and familiar in these characters, said our leader. Well, we have seen a buried city of ancient days, my friend, and we carry a wonderful piece of knowledge with us to the grave. There is no more to be learned. Our book of knowledge is closed. I agree with you that the sooner the end comes, the better. It could not now be long delayed. The air was stagnant and dreadful. So heavy was it with carbon products that the oxygen could hardly force its way out against the pressure. By standing on the settee, one was able to get a gulp of purer air, but the mephitic reek was slowly rising. Dr. Marico folded his arms with an air of resignation and sank his head upon his breast. Scanlon was now overpowered by the fumes and was already sprawling upon the floor. My own head was swimming, and I felt an intolerable weight at my chest. I closed my eyes, and my senses were rapidly slipping away. Then I opened them for one last glimpse of that world which I was leaving, and as I did so, I staggered to my feet with a hoarse scream of amazement. A human face was looking in at us through the porthole! Was it my delirium? I clutched at the shoulder of Marico and shook him violently. He sat up and stared, wonderstruck and speechless, at this apparition. If he saw it as well as I, it was no figment of the brain. The face was long and thin, dark in complexion, with a short pointed beard, and two vivid eyes darting here and there in quick questioning glances, which took in every detail of our situation. The utmost amazement was visible upon the man's face. Our lights were now full on, and it must indeed have been a strange and vivid picture which presented itself to his gaze in that tiny chamber of death, where one man lay senseless and two others glared out at him with the twisted, contorted features of dying men, cyanosed by incipient asphyxiation. We both had our hands to our throats, and our heaving chests carried their message of despair. The man gave a wave of his hand and hurried away. "He has deserted us," cried Marico. "Or gone for help. Let us get Scanlon on the couch. It's death for him down there." We dragged the mechanic onto the settee and propped his head against the cushions. His face was grey, and he murmured in delirium, but his pulse was still perceptible. "There is hope for us yet," I croaked. "But it is madness," cried Marico. "How can man live at the bottom of the ocean? How can he breathe? It is collective hallucination. My young friend, we are going mad." Looking out at the bleak, lonely grey landscape in the dreary spectral light, I felt that it might be as Marico said. Then suddenly I was aware of movement. Shadows were flitting through the distant water. They hardened and thickened into moving figures. A crowd of people were hurrying across the ocean bed in our direction. An instant later they had assembled in front of the porthole and were pointing and gesticulating in animated debate. There were several women in the crowd, but the greater part were men, one of whom, a powerful figure with a very large head and a full black beard, was clearly a person of authority. He made a swift inspection of our steel shell, and since the edge of our base projected over the place on which we rested, he was able to see that there was a hinged trapdoor at the bottom. He now sent a messenger flying back, while he made energetic and commanding signs to us to open the door from within. "Why not?" I asked. "We may as well be drowned as be smothered. I can stand it no longer." "We may not be drowned," said Marico. "The water entering from below cannot rise above the level of the compressed air. Give Scanlon some brandy. He must make an effort, if it is his last one." I forced a drink down the mechanic's throat. He gulped and looked round him with wondering eyes. Between us we got him erect on the settee and stood on either side of him. He was still half dazed, but in a few words I explained the situation.
"There is a chance of chlorine poisoning if the water reaches the batteries," said Marico. "Open every air tube, for the more pressure we can get, the less water may enter. Now help me while I pull upon the lever."
We bent our weight upon it and yanked up the circular plate from the bottom of our little home, though I felt like a suicide as I did so. The green water, sparkling and gleaming under our light, came gurgling and surging in. It rose rapidly to our feet, to our knees, to our waists, and there it stopped. But the pressure of the air was intolerable. Our heads buzzed, and the drums of our ears were bursting. We could not have lived in such an atmosphere for long. Only by clutching at the rack could we save ourselves from falling back into the waters beneath us. From our higher position we could no longer see through the portholes, nor could we imagine what steps were being taken for our deliverance. Indeed, that any effective help could come to us seemed beyond the power of thought, and yet there was a commanding and purposeful air about these people, and especially about that squat bearded chieftain, which inspired vague hopes. Suddenly we were aware of his face looking up at us through the water beneath, and an instant later he had passed through the circular opening and had clambered on to the settee, so that he was standing by our side, a short, sturdy figure, not higher than my shoulder, but surveying us with large brown eyes which were full of a half-amused confidence, as who should say, "You poor devils, you think you are in a very bad way, but I can clearly see the road out." Only now was I aware of a very amazing thing. The man, if indeed he was of the same humanity as ourselves, had a transparent envelope all round him, which enveloped his head and body, while his arms and legs were free. So translucent was it that no one could detect it in the water, but now that he was in the air beside us it glistened like silver, though it remained as clear as the finest glass. On either shoulder he had a curious rounded projection beneath the clear protective sheath. It looked like an oblong box pierced with many holes, and gave him an appearance as if he were wearing epaulettes. When our new friend had joined us, another face appeared in the aperture of the bottom, and thrust through it what seemed like a great bubble of glass. Three of these in succession were passed in, and floated upon the surface of the water. Then six small boxes were handed up, and our new acquaintance tied one with the straps attached to them to each of our shoulders, whence they stood up like his own. Already I began to surmise that no infraction of natural law was involved in the life of these strange people, and that while one box in some new fashion was a producer of air, the other was an absorber of waste products. He now passed the transparent suits over our heads, and we felt that they clasped us tightly in the upper arm and waist by elastic bands, so that no water could penetrate. Within we breathed with perfect ease, and it was a joy to me to see Marico looking out at me with his eyes twinkling as of old behind his glasses, while Bill Scanlon's grin assured me that the life-giving oxygen had done its work, and that he was his cheerful self once more. Our rescuer looked from one to another of us with grave satisfaction, and then motioned to us to follow him through the trap-door and out onto the floor of the ocean. A dozen willing hands were outstretched to pull us through and to sustain our first faltering steps as we staggered with our feet deep in the slimy ooze. Even now I cannot get past the marvel of it. There we were, the three of us, unhurt and at our ease, at the bottom of a 5-mile abyss of water. Where was that terrific pressure which had exercised the imagination of so many scientists? We were no more affected by it than were the dainty fish which swam around us. It is true that, so far as our bodies were concerned, we were protected by these delicate bells of vitrine, which were in truth tougher than the strongest steel. But even our limbs, which were exposed, felt no more than a firm constriction from the water, which one learned in time to disregard. It was wonderful to stand together and to look back at the shell from which we had emerged. We had left the batteries at work, and it was a wondrous object with its streams of yellow light
flooding out from each side, while clouds of fishes gathered at each window. As we watched it, the leader took Mariko by the hand, and we followed them both across the watery morass, clumping heavily through the sticky surface. And now a most surprising incident occurred, which was clearly as astonishing to these strange new companions of ours as to ourselves. Above our heads there appeared a small dark object descending from the darkness above us and swinging down until it reached the bed of the ocean within a very short distance from where we stood. It was, of course, the deep-sea lead from the Stratford above us, making a sounding of that watery gulf with which the name of the expedition was to be associated. We had seen it already upon its downward path, and we could well understand that the tragedy of our disappearance had suspended the operation, but that after a pause it had been concluded, with little thought that it would finish almost at our feet. They were unconscious, apparently, that they had touched bottom, for the lead lay motionless in the ooze. Above me stretched the taut piano wire which connected me through 5 miles of water with the deck of our vessel. Oh, that it were possible to write a note and to attach it! The idea was absurd, and yet could I not send some message which would show them that we were still conscious? My coat was covered by my glass bell, and the pockets were unapproachable, but I was free below the waist, and my handkerchief chanced to be in my trousers pocket. I pulled it out and tied it above the top of the lead. The weight itself at once disengaged itself by its automatic mechanism, and presently I saw my white wisp of linen flying upwards to that world which I may never see again. Our new acquaintances examined the 75 pounds of lead with great interest, and finally carried it off with us as we went upon our way. We had only walked a couple of 100 yards, threading our way among the hummocks, when we halted before a small square-cut door with solid pillars on either side and an inscription across the lintel. It was open, and we passed through it to a large bare chamber. There was a sliding partition worked by a crank from within, and this was drawn across behind us. We could, of course, hear nothing in our glass helmets, but after standing a few minutes, we were aware that a powerful pump must be at work, for we saw the level of the water sinking rapidly above us. In less than a quarter of an hour we were standing upon a sloppy stone-flagged pavement, while our new friends were busy in undoing the fastenings of our transparent suits. An instant later, there we stood, breathing perfectly pure air in a warm, well-lighted atmosphere, while the dark people of the abyss, smiling and chattering, crowded round us with handshakings and friendly pattings. It was a strange rasping tongue that they spoke, and no word of it was intelligible to us, but the smile on the face and the light of friendship in the eye are understandable even in the waters under the earth. The glass suits were hung on numbered pegs upon the wall, and the kindly folk half led and half pushed us to an inner door which opened on to a long downward sloping corridor. When it closed again behind us, there was nothing to remind us of the stupendous fact that we were the involuntary guests of an unknown race at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, and cut for ever from the world to which we belonged. Now that the terrific strain had been so suddenly eased, we were all exhausted. Even Bill Scanlon, who was a pocket Hercules, dragged his feet along the floor, while Mariko and I were only too glad to lean heavily upon our guides. Yet, weary as I was, I took in every detail as we passed. That the air came from some air-making machine was very evident, for it issued in puffs from circular openings in the walls. The light was diffused, and was clearly an extension of that fluor system which was already engaging the attention of our European engineers when the filament and lamp were dispensed with. It shone from long cylinders of clear glass which were suspended along the cornices of the passages. So much I had observed when our descent was checked, and we were ushered into a large sitting-room, thickly carpeted and well furnished with gilded chairs and sloping sofas which brought back vague memories of Egyptian tombs. The crowd had been dismissed, and only the bearded man with 2 attendants remained. "Manda," he repeated several times, tapping himself on the chest. Then he pointed to each of us in turn, and repeated the words Maraco, Headley, and Scanlon, until he had them perfect. He then motioned us to be seated, and said a word to one of the attendants, who left the room, and returned presently, escorting a very ancient gentleman, white-haired and long-bearded, with a curious conical cap of black cloth upon his head. I should have said that all these folk were dressed in coloured tunics, which extended to their knees, with high boots of fish-skin or shagreen. The venerable newcomer was clearly a physician, for he examined each of us in turn, placing his hand upon our brows and closing his own eyes as if receiving a mental impression as to our condition. Apparently he was by no means satisfied, for he shook his head and said a few grave words to Manda. The latter at once sent the attendant out once more, and he brought in a tray of eatables and a flask of wine, which were laid before us. We were too weary to ask ourselves what they were, but we felt the better for the meal. We were then led to another room, where three beds had been prepared, and on one of these I flung myself down. I have a dim recollection of Bill Scanlon coming across and sitting beside me. "Say, Bo, that jolt of brandy saved my life," said he. "But where are we, anyhow?" "I know no more than you do." "Well, I am ready to hit the hay," he said sleepily, as he turned to his bed. "Say, that wine was fine. Thank God Volstead never got down here." They were the last words I heard as I sank into the most profound sleep that I can ever recall. End of section 2.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.